This is Natalie Leaven, everyone. And I haven't got her bio in front of me, but I'm sure you all know who she is.
Doesn't matter whether you do or don't. Don't worry about it. I should start by saying I'm getting rather used at conferences to being the straight act after Mike. So I do apologise for that. I'm afraid I can't begin to emulate Mike. So here comes the tedious bit with lots of cases. But following on from Mike, I just would like you all to think about how many of the cases I'm about to refer to could not be brought under a combination of the changes that have already been brought into legal aid, the changes which we know are going to be brought in, and the pretty awful, in my view, changes in terms of the impact on the rule of law, which are in the most recent consultation document. And I know this isn't part of my brief, but I think there is a real danger amongst this audience of consultation fatigue. This will be the third set of consultation proposals coming from this government in a little over 12 months, which will impact directly on you. And I completely appreciate that many of you may not have read it and may feel, what's the point in responding? I can't promise you there is a point, but this most recent set of changes, massively impacting on the ability or reality of interveners getting involved in JRs, massively impacting on the risk basis for solicitors bringing cases forward. Please read what the government is now proposing. Please think about the impact on the rule of law. Don't necessarily write great screeds to the MOJ, because I don't know whether people here are from the MOJ or not, but my faith in them either reading or inwardly digesting what you write is not great, it has to be said. But please write to your MPs, particularly if they're Tory or Lib Dem MPs, and try to get across the message that judicial review is incredibly important for ordinary people, for people who may never realise they need it, but may do in the future. And it is such a critical safeguard within the British Constitution. And try to get those government MPs to understand that and to start thinking about these reforms, because without that process, they will go through by default. So the other thing I'd just like you to think about when we're going through some of these cases is the, I find, slightly bizarre suggestion from the government that the courts are unduly pro-claimant, unduly minded to interfere in matters that are properly those for the executive and the parliament. I have to say, I think that those members of the government who suggest that have simply not sat in judicial review courts. As I'm sure all of you know, the odds are always stacked against claimants. It's always very difficult to persuade a court that the government has got it wrong or that the balance has not been struck in the right place under the Human Rights Act. So, again, that whole agenda about, well, this is about, we need to pull back from these naughty courts getting involved in what is properly under the British Constitution for Parliament, is just a parallel universe to the universe I've practiced in for a number of years. Okay, so we come to the cases. At least we hope we do if AIDS machine works, which it doesn't. Ah, it does. It's very difficult, I find, to do an annual review. There are so many cases, many of them critically important in their own fields, that this is necessarily a rather personal snapshot. I'm also conscious that in specialist areas, you've got a number of specialist breakout groups on things like right to die and prisoners. So I'm going to skip over cases quite quickly, and I apologise if either I totally trash the facts, which I may well do on a number of these cases, but also necessarily don't cover all the cases which you may feel are particularly important. I wanted to start, as it were, at the top, the most overarching level, the level of jurisdiction, and start with jurisdiction within the Human Rights Act and the slightly vexed issue of the territorial scope of the Human Rights Act, which has particularly arisen under cases under Article 2 and the right to life and the investigative duty under Article 2. And the reason this has arisen is because of the sad fact that a number of members of the British Army were either killed or injured in largely the cases relate to Iraq rather than Afghanistan. And this is the second Smith case that's got to the Supreme Court on this issue. In both cases, very sadly, brought by mothers of sons who died in Iraq. And the issue is whether they could bring claims that both for cases where the soldiers died, but also where they were injured, bring cases under Article 2 in the Susan Smith case in relation to damages, but it doesn't really matter whether it's for this purpose of damages or the investigative duty. The Supreme Court revisited the earlier Catherine Smith case, don't get confused, and happily they revisited it without writing 9 judgments, none of which entirely agreed with each other, which is what they did in Catherine Smith. And they revisited it in the light of the European Court's decision in Al Skaney. And the conclusion now reached, which is at least relatively clear-cut, is that the United Kingdom Article 1 jurisdiction can extend to providing protection under Article 2 to members of the armed forces outside the UK. And the question, the key issue, is the authority and control of the UK government in the particular situation that arises. So one can see it's going to be a lot easier to have authority and control over your own armed forces than it would be in the case of Iraqi nationals, although ultimately there's a judgment to be made. The other thing to say about this case, it was an application by the government to strike out, largely on the basis of the earlier Catherine Smith case. The Supreme Court didn't strike out the case, saying that in terms of the substantive issue, whether or not there was a breach of Article 2, that in a combat situation, there was a finely judged balance to be made on the facts, and that wasn't appropriate for a strikeout. Next case, also on jurisdiction, but went the other way. This is a case of Sandiford, which I think Aidan O'Neill will probably be talking about more in one of the breakout sessions. Miss Sandiford was a lady who was facing the death penalty in Indonesia, and the issue raised was the refusal of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to pay her legal fees in Indonesia. There's a UK government policy not to pay, to give consular assistance, but not to pay legal fees. And the argument put on behalf of the claimant, Miss Sandiford, was that that was a breach of a European directive, and it fell within the scope of that directive, and therefore the duties under the European Union Charter of Fundamental Rights arose. Now, interestingly, and I think in some ways helpfully, the Court of Appeal applied the same test or the same approach as is now the approach under the Human Rights Convention, which is to look at the question of authority and control. What is the degree of authority and control that the UK government has in that particular situation? And perhaps unsurprisingly, they found that Miss Sandiford was under the authority and control of the Indonesian government. She was locked up in an Indonesian prison subject to Indonesian criminal justice law and not of the UK. And the fact that she had been given consular assistance by the UK government did not engage the charter, did not fall within the scope of the charter. So different jurisdictional conclusions under the convention and the charter, but same analysis. Okay, different topic, different slide. Disclosure and reliance on documents. I think this is one that comes in more for newspaper interest, really, than any of you are likely to be applying it on a day-to-day level. This was yet another part of the Chagos Islanders trying to fight the government. In this case, they were seeking to rely on documents which suggested that the imposition of a marine protection area around the Chagos Islands, which is now the reason why they are or the ostensible reason why the Chagos Islanders cannot go back, was shown by various documents revealed by WikiLeaks to perhaps not be the entire truth of why the marine protection area had been imposed. There was a saga as to whether these documents could be relied upon or not. And in the end, the court found that because the documents had been leaked in breach of clear principles of diplomatic communication, that they could not be relied upon in court because it was a settled principle of international law that diplomatic communications are inviolable and therefore cannot be referred to without consent. Another case, partly perhaps more relevant for its entertainment value, but also with some wider interest, is the case of Evans and the Attorney General to the Prince of Wales. I'm particularly nervous about this one because I know that people involved in the case are in the room. The issue was whether the disclosure of communications between the Prince of Wales and government ministers should be disclosed under, I've put there, FOI, but also the Environmental Information Regulations. And as you may know, there is a specific provision in FOIA by which the minister or the Attorney General can veto disclosure even where the tribunal has ordered it. Now, the upper tribunal ordered that disclosure of these communications should be made. The Attorney General, and I should say that's not the Attorney General to the Prince of Wales, that's Dominic Grieve, the Attorney General. The Attorney General chose to veto the disclosure on the grounds, to paraphrase, of the importance of keeping the communications between the heir to the throne and the government confidential. I think the rationale was that the heir to the throne had to learn how to step into his role, and therefore it was important that this educational function could be done without it being disclosed. I make no comment. What I think is interesting about the case is the interaction between this power of veto in the statute and the role of the upper tribunal in deciding whether or not the documents should be disclosed. And the court came down firmly on the side of the Prince of Wales and the Attorney General and said that his judgment not to disclose the documents or to veto the disclosure was not irrational. It was based on the public interest, and it wasn't about second-guessing the tribunal's decision. It was an application of the parliamentary scheme which allowed the Attorney General to exercise such a veto. So it's quite an interesting case about the relationship of the powers and the decision of the upper tribunal and the powers of the executive under a statutory scheme. And also interesting because, of course, the same principle was being applied under the Environmental Information Regulations, which have their source in the European a European directive. Oops. Aid. Where's he gone? hang on, let's see. Oh. Well, I've just pushed it once. Let's try pressing the red one. Right, wait a minute.
Do you want to go back or forth?
Do I want to go back towards? I want to go back. Yeah, stop. Brilliant. No, it's all right. Okay, sorry, I'll try and keep pressing the button. Right, next issue, which again is quite a kind of big picture issue, closed hearings at Bank Mellat and the Treasury. I should have said at the beginning, these slides don't necessarily follow the pattern of the talk. So those of you who are trying to follow the talk, I wouldn't bother. I'd concentrate on the slides. And there's one or two cases which aren't in the talk, and I'll try and alert you to them. Bank Mellat was a case about measures taken under the Counter-Terrorism Act to control the Iranian Bank Mellat, access to UK markets on the grounds of involvement in the Iranian nuclear programme. And the issue in the there were two judgments. The second judgment, I think, is much more fact-specific, probably not of huge interest to this audience, but the first judgment is about whether or not the Supreme Court could hold a closed hearing in order to hear national security documents about the relationship, presumably, the relationship between Bank Mellat and counter-terrorism objectives. And one of the things that's interesting in the case is, as I've put in the last bullet, there was very strong dissent from a number of members of the Supreme Court. But the majority found that the Supreme Court could hold closed hearings if it was necessary to dispose of the appeal. National security was clearly a ground on which it might be necessary to hold a closed hearing. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the Supreme Court was satisfied, although I think somewhat against its in some ways its better judgment, that national security plus the provisions that Parliament had enshrined in the Counter-Terrorism Act struck the appropriate balance in terms of the public interest. And therefore, it was appropriate for the Supreme Court to hold a closed hearing. Okay, let's move on to a few cases a bit closer to one's day-to-day existence. I've grouped these two cases together because they're both about scope of local authority judgment. The first case, SL and Westminster, is about an asylum seeker who was admitted to a psychiatric hospital with post-traumatic stress disorder, discharged, and then given continued assistance by Westminster. And the question was whether that assistance amounted to care and attention within the meaning of Section 21 of the National Assistance Act, and therefore he had a right to be housed under the National to accommodation under the National Assistance Act. And the court found that care and attention in that context meant more than just looking after someone. It involved looking after someone rather than just monitoring or giving them help. And the services in question, which were being provided by Westminster, were not related to accommodation and therefore did not fall within Section 21 of the NAA. But the reason I've highlighted that case and the next one is that in both cases, the Supreme Court put a lot of weight on leaving the judgments under these acts. The next act case is about the Housing Act 1996 and whether people could be found to be living together with family members if they were housed in separate units of accommodation. And again, in that case, the court said no. Accommodation didn't mean one unit of accommodation. You could live together in separate units of accommodation, and there was a matter of judgment for the local authority as to whether the accommodation in question was close enough as for the family to be living together. Now, they're both cases about specific provisions in specific acts. I was in the second, I wasn't in the first. And what strikes me about these cases is the emphasis in the Supreme Court of leaving questions like this to local authority judgments, local authority common sense, as was said in the first case, but also the extreme consciousness at that level, particularly, I think, of Lady Hale and Lord Carnworth, of the great pressure that local authorities are under their need to make difficult judgments, and a desire at the Supreme Court level not to intervene in those local authority judgments. I was surprised in Sharif because I thought, well, Lady Hale and Lord Carnworth, both very involved in homelessness in their younger days, they would both be very sympathetic to my client who was being, family was being split up in this, two separate bedsits. But no, the take they had was, this is a hard-pressed local authority, it needs to be allowed to exercise its housing duties to the best of its own judgments and financial abilities. And I think it's just there's a need perhaps amongst this audience to understand where the courts are now coming from on that. It's one of the perhaps slightly unexpected aspects of the what has come to be known as the age of austerity. Okay, Article 8, disclosure of previous convictions, T and the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester. This is a case about a series of people who had either cautions or convictions in their very young days, where those cautions or convictions were spent under the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, but were still being disclosed under CRB checks and similar processes. And the challenge was brought on Article 8, that disclosure was an interference with private life. The court agreed that disclosure of such matters could be an interference with private life. The court found that the schemes were incompatible because they had blanket requirements to disclose, rather than having a more nuanced and proportionate balance on disclosure issues. And one of the things that didn't go into the balance, because it was a bright line disclosure rule, was considerations of the relevance of the information to the employers. I think it's an important case because it emphasises a line of case law going back through cases in the House of Lords like Wright, where the court will be quite strict in proportionality cases under Article 8 that decision makers have to exercise a proportionate balance rather than have absolute rules. Having said that, the court did expressly say it was okay that some offences were so serious that they were never spent, such as, obviously, murder. But in the main, the courts have been sympathetic to arguments that blanket rules under Article 8 are not proportionate. Back to Article 2 and investigative duties, case of Moussa and the Secretary of State for Defence. This was a case about investigation into allegations of historic ill-treatment of Iraqis by UK armed forces and the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, IHAT as it's known. And the court found that the IHAT was not sufficiently independent of government to meet the Article 2 requirements. The inquiry had to be effective and independent. And effectively, the court found that meant either there had to be an overarching public inquiry or an inquest. For those of you who do or would like to do Article 2 investigation cases, I think this is an important case because it says a lot about the level of scrutiny on independence, which may well also have relevance to other cases, possibly not NHS cases because they have a pretty well worked out scheme, but other cases where there's government involvement in death. And it's also important because, of course, Article 2 has now been extended not just to people, the investigative duty, not just to people who actually died, but people who nearly died. So you can see that the level of independence required in the investigation is an important point. Okay, series of benefits cases which I thought were worth touching on, most of them unsuccessful, but that's the way with benefits cases. First of all, the bedroom tax case and the argument that the bedroom tax was indirectly discriminatory because it failed to meet the needs of the disabled. And the rationale in the High Court for rejecting the claim was that it was impossible to define one class who were discriminated against by the bedroom tax because it couldn't be said to be the class of the disabled generally or any specific group of the disabled because everything depended on the particular facts and disability in question. And therefore, the test was whether the Secretary of State's margin of appreciation was manifestly without reasonable foundation, and the court found it plainly was not, partly because there was this lack of clear class. Having said that, Secretary of State was under an ongoing obligation to ensure the means chosen were proportionate, and some of you may know that that there is a discretionary scheme, albeit I suspect not a very effective one in this area. I think the case is awaiting a decision in the Court of Appeal as to whether permission to appeal will be granted. Oops.
Natalie, you've got a few minutes.
Yeah, I know. But would help if this thing worked. The next case is a bit more hopeful and one which I think may be of interest to a number of you, not just in the benefits context. Case of MM and DM, case that I can happily say was the PLP were our instructing solicitors. This is a challenge under the Equalities Act duty to make reasonable adjustments, a challenge to the Secretary of State's process for considering claims for employment support allowance in respect of claimants with mental health problems. And it's just worth understanding the issue in the case is that for those with mental health problems, it's very difficult for them necessarily to appreciate the need to put in medical evidence at the beginning of the process, for reasons such as lack of insight into their own condition, lack of understanding of the process, fear of the process, a lot of factors that go with the nature of their mental health problems. And we argued that the failure to put in place a proper system was the failure to make a reasonable adjustment. So it was quite a novel case in terms of the nature of the reasonable adjustment that was being sought. I think it would probably be fair to say, three quarters won in the upper tribunal. The upper tribunal found that claimants with mental health problems were at a substantial disadvantage, but it went on to say it needed further evidence as to whether the adjustment that we were seeking was reasonable. And the tribunal sought to weigh up the benefits and disbenefits in terms of the overall impact. The Secretary of State has, instead of waiting for the next stage in the upper tribunal, has run off to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal is hearing the case next week. But I think it's quite an important case generally on reasonable adjustments. Riley and Wilson, case some of you may have seen in the newspapers, whether or not the job seeker allowance regulations are ultra vires in respect of making people work for their benefits without pay. Court of Appeal found the regulations were unlawful because they failed to prescribe a scheme. There is an issue about the requirement to publish policies and information, particularly in the light of the House of Lords judgment in Lumber. We've had the case in the Supreme Court. We're waiting judgment. Prisoners and the right to a fair hearing. This is possibly, Osborne and Booth, possibly the most important case of the year. Came out last week for all of you, because it's all about when prisoners have a right to an oral hearing before a parole board. And the Supreme Court, perhaps slightly surprisingly, came out incredibly strongly in favour of the duty of the parole board to hold oral hearings. Now, it may be that it ends up being limited just to parole boards and just to the right to liberty, but on the face of it, the Supreme Court judgment, and there's only one judgment, swings the balance back very strongly in favour of the need for oral hearings. And the same analysis can be put in lots of different contexts. The factors that Lord Reed focused on in deciding whether or not an oral hearing was necessary, whether important facts are in dispute, whether it's necessary to have an oral hearing to put your case effectively, whether it's unfair for the decision to be made on the papers, whether the board could otherwise fairly make an assessment of risk, and whenever the board thought the prisoner was potentially suitable for release. Well, I would challenge any of you to find a parole board case that wouldn't fall within one of those dots. So I should think the parole board are probably tearing their hair out at this judgment, but I think it also potentially has implications for other areas. I'm thinking of POCA and POVA, that some of you will be, Safeguarding Vulnerable Adult Groups Act, and many other areas of public law where there are arguments around oral hearings. There's one other case on prisoners, which I think Freudian slip by me, I thought was years ago, but actually I only managed to lose it 9 months ago, which you should know about. James and the UK, the final word in the IPP debacle by the government. And it's an important case in Strasbourg, albeit only in the chamber, because the Strasbourg court found that there could be circumstances, and indeed there were circumstances in those cases, where prisoners who were being detained in circumstances where they had no means to progress through the system because the government had failed to put funding in place for the coursework which would allow them to go to the parole board and say they're not a risk, those prisoners were detained for at least a period in breach of Article 5.1. So we won in the divisional court, I was the government, we won in the divisional court, won in the Court of Appeal, won in the House of Lords, lost in Strasbourg. Very, very, not necessarily surprising on its facts, but very innovative judgment about the scope of Article 5.1. And if you have a 5.1 case, well worth a good read. Right, Nicholson, I'm not going to say any more about than note it. It's the right to die case, Court of Appeal said, matter for Parliament, not for us. Walton and the Scottish Ministers, this is a European environmental case, so you may think, why am I referring to it? It's an important case about the scope of the court's discretion in EU cases. The traditional line since Barclay has been, if you've got an EU case and you can, the court finds a breach of EU law, then the court has effectively no discretion not to quash. So our Cotton-style arguments about no difference don't apply. Lord Carnworth, who has never been a fan of Barclay, was clearly delighted to have got to the Supreme Court and to, although he didn't, they didn't say they were overturning Barclay, in practice they came damn close, because they have now said in the Supreme Court no different approach in EU cases and any other cases to the approach to discretion not to quash. So if you've got an EU case, this is critical. And then just finally, I thought I'd mention two upcoming cases which you might want to keep your eyes open for. One is there is a challenge to the fast-track detention scheme in immigration on the grounds of common law unfairness and breach of Article 5. Permission has been granted by the admin court. I think the hearing's in February or March, so who knows, but if we get anywhere, I think that could be a very important case. And secondly, there are a series of cases around the D in the UK, N in the UK issue, about in what circumstances can people who are very, very seriously ill be sent back to their home countries engaging Articles 3 and 8. There's about three cases in the pipeline. There's a judgment about to come out on one of them. It's a very uncomfortable area of law, and I suspect that there will be a revisiting over the next year of the principles in N and D. Sorry, I know I've gone over my time, but Mike went over his two. Okay, so I only went a little bit over.
Thank you very much, Natalie, for a very detailed summary of a year in GAR.
Sorry, no problem.
Our next speaker is Shahid Fatima from Blackstone Chambers, who's going to talk to us about international law in public law claims.
I'll sort it out for you, don't worry, I'll bring it for you. Do you want still or spot?